Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Welcome back. We have a monumental task ahead of us today. You've given us this wealth of material focusing entirely on Gabriel Garcia Marquez Gabo, as many know him, and his defining masterpiece, 100 Years of Solitude. Cien años de soledad.
That's right.
So our mission really is to navigate these seven generations of the Buendia family and try to pull out the deepest insights about history, memory, and, well, that inescapable loneliness the title promises.
It really is the essential novel of the Latin American boom. It's publication in 1967. It just changed everything for global literature. And you can't really grasp it without starting with Gabo himself.
Right. His background.
Exactly. He poured his childhood at Aracataca, Colombia, you know, all the local stories, the superstitions, his family's sort of ghost tales, and that violent political past. He poured all of that into the foundations of Macondo, his fictional town.
And digging into the sources you shared, the thing that just leaps out immediately is his style. Magical realism. Now, for a lot of people hearing that term, it might just sound like fantasy writing. Is that fair? And why did he choose that style? Priests levitating, women floating away?
No, not quite fair. And that's a common misunderstanding, actually. Magical realism isn't really fantasy in the typical sense. It's more about treating the fantastic, the impossible, as if it's completely ordinary. Mm-hmm. Mundane, even.
Okay.
Gabo's true genius lies in grounding those miracles. Like, yes, the priest levitating after his hot chocolate. Grounding them in such meticulous, almost stark reality that they feel... well, they feel inevitable within that world.
Yeah.
And this technique allowed him to explore these incredibly profound, often brutal historical truths, things like political violence, collective forgetting, in a way that that street realism probably couldn't capture.
So it validates a worldview where, say, a ghost is just as real, just as present as a civil war.
Precisely. And that unique blending, that synthesis, earned him the Nobel Prize in 1982.
Okay, so let's set the scene a bit more for you, the listener. What's the basic premise here? What's the story about in this massive universe?
At its heart, the novel is this epic saga of one family, the Buendias. It follows their rise, their whole century-long history, and ultimately the apocalyptic fall of their town, Macondo.
And Macondo isn't just a town, is it?
No, it really functions as this tragic microcosm of Latin American history itself. When the town is first founded by the patriarch, José Arcadio Buendía, it's almost like an Eden, famously described as the world was so recent that many things lacked names, and in order to indicate them, it was necessary to point.
Wow, like a completely blank slate, pure potential. But the sources are clear. The Buendías don't exactly get to write their own story on that canvas, do they?
They really don't. They're living out a destiny that, well, it's already been written. The entire saga unfolds according to a prophecy. It's inscribed on these ancient Sanskrit parchments by a gypsy character, Melquiades.
Sanskrit? That's fascinating. It suggests this fate was sealed long before Macondo even existed.
Exactly. It implies a deep, almost inescapable historical weight. And the family finds itself trapped in this relentless cycle. They keep repeating names, repeating fatal flaws, and they're all afflicted by this one central curse, an inescapable, profound solitude.
Okay, let's unpack that. Let's start with the first generations, because these characters really seem to embody different kinds of that solitude. The founding couple, José Arcadio Buendía and Úrsula Iguarán.
Right. José Arcadio, he's a restless founder, the brilliant, visionary patriarch. He's the one with the physical force, the drive to build Macondo. But his curiosity, this boundless scientific curiosity, becomes his downfall.
How so?
He gets obsessed with alchemy, with the strange wonders Melquiades brings, things like ice, magnets. He's always chasing the next great discovery, the next bit of knowledge. But this intellectual pursuit isolates him. It drives him deeper and deeper into himself until eventually he descends into this kind of solitary madness.
And he ends up tied to the chestnut tree.
Yes. Spends his final years tied to that tree in the yard, speaking only Latin. A complete prisoner of his own mind. A truly tragic arc from founder to forgotten fixture.
And Úrsula, she sees it all happen. What's her role in this?
Úrsula is the opposite in many ways. She's the anchor, the pragmatic matriarch, the keeper of the family's memory. She lives for well over 100 years, desperately trying to halt their decline, trying to impose some order.
She's the one afraid of the curse.
Very much so. She's terrified of the prophecy, especially the part about an incestuous union producing a child with a pig's tail. She fights against the family's destructive tendencies, but her incredibly long life just serves to confirm the sad truth. The cycle's just too powerful. She can't stop it.
That brings us to the second generation and Colonel Aureliano Buendia. He's maybe the most famous character from the book, but his life seems to represent futility.
Absolute futility, yes.
Yeah.
He starts as this quiet artisan, meticulously crafting tiny golden fishes, a very solitary internal figure already. Then he transforms into this legendary liberal general.
He fights dozens of wars.
32 civil wars, according to the novel. And he loses every single one. Think about that. This relentless, pointless conflict just hollows him out completely. His becomes this profound political and emotional solitude.
An empty shell is how some describe him.
Exactly. Incapable of real love, real connection. He ends up back where he started in a way, spending his final years melting down those little golden fishes only to remake them again and again, an endless, futile, self-imposed labor.
And his sister, Amaranta, provides this devastating contrast. Her solitude isn't from war or politics, it's chosen.
Completely self-inflicted. Her life is just consumed by bitterness, by pride, by this fiercely repressed passion. She drives one suitor to suicide, pushes away all others, partly out of rivalry with her adopted sister, Rebecca.
And the shroud.
Yes, that haunting detail. She spends years weaving and then unweaving her own funeral shroud, a morbid, solitary ritual she performs until the day she dies. Just a tragic monument to denial and loneliness.
Okay, moving through the generations, we get to Jose Arcadio Segundo. His solitude seems different. It feels purposeful, almost.
Yes, his is fascinating. He becomes the family's solitary witness. His struggle isn't about internal demons or lost love in the same way. It's about truth.
The banana massacre.
Precisely. He's the only known survivor, the only one who carries the direct memory of the banana worker massacre. This horrific event where thousands of striking workers are systematically gunned down by the army in the town square.
And then the cover-up, the official denial that the massacre ever happened. This is where the novel's political critique really bites, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's Gabo showing how power attempts to rewrite history, to simply erase inconvenient truths. And Jose Arcadio Segundo, he dedicates the rest of his life in total isolation to preserving that memory.
How does he do that?
He basically becomes a recluse. He lives hidden away in Melquiades' old room, surrounded by the parchments, guarding this horrific truth against the town's collective amnesia, the government's denial. His solitude becomes this act of fierce political resistance.
Let's broaden the lens now, away from just the individuals, to Macondo itself. You said it mirrors Latin American history. The story seems to unfold in these distinct waves hitting the town.
That's a great way to put it. Historical waves crashing over Macondo. The first waves are that idyllic founding, then the loss of innocence when politics and violence arrive.
Right, the civil wars that Colonel Aureliano gets embroiled in, that shatters the initial isolation.
Completely. It plunges the town into cycles of conflict, transforming it. But then, after all that internal strife, the outside world really arrives.
Yes. Wave three. This is where the railroad comes in and the American Banana Company. The sources are really clear. This is a sharp critique of neocolonialism.
Without a doubt, foreign capital rushes in. It brings industrialization, a kind of boom time, immense wealth, at least for some.
Like Aureliano Segundo's legendary parties and excesses.
Exactly. That hedonism is fueled by this exploitative prosperity. The town looks like it's thriving, but it's built on a rotten foundation. The decay is already setting in.
And then comes wave four, the catastrophe that seals Macondo's doom. It starts with the brutal suppression of the workers.
The massacre. It's depicted as utterly horrifying. Thousands executed in moments, their bodies loaded onto trains like bananas and dumped into the sea.
And the official story?
Nothing happened. The government simply denies it ever occurred. And chillingly, the town mostly goes along with it. They embrace this lie, this historical vacuum.
And right after that erasure of truth, nature itself seems to respond. The great deluge.
Yes, it's described in almost biblical terms. Rain that lasts for 4 years, 11 months, and 2 days. Nonstop.
Wow.
This endless rain literally washes away the banana company's infrastructure, its influence. But it also just rots the town. It washes away Macondo's vitality, plunging it into this terminal, irreversible decay. Isolation returns, but it's the isolation of death, not innocence.
Which leads us to the climax. The town is physically crumbling, overgrown, being eaten by ants. And the last Buendia, Aureliano Babilonia, the scholar, is consumed by one final task.
Deciphering those Sanskrit parchments left by Melquiades. He's the ultimate inward-looking Buendia, locked away, obsessed with the text.
And then the final taboo.
The final doomed act.
Mm.
The incestuous union with his aunt, Amaranta Ursula. This passionate, genuine love affair, ironically, but one that fulfills the prophecy's curse. It produces the child with the pig's tail.
And as the child dies, and the final hurricane descends to wipe Macondo off the map, Aureliano Babilonia finally cracks the code. This moment. It's just breathtaking in the book.
It truly is. He has this sudden, shattering revelation. He realizes he's not just reading a prophecy about the future. He is reading the entire history of his family exactly as it happened, right up to the present moment.
In real time.
In real time. He understands that every choice, every love, every war, every single moment of solitude was preordained from the beginning, written down centuries ago.
Mm-hmm.
And as he reads the very last line of the parchments, the hurricane obliterates everything.
Ending with that devastating final line from the text, which is also the novel's final line. Races condemned to 100 years of solitude did not have a second opportunity on Earth. Just chills.
Absolutely.
So if we try to connect those dots, what defines this solitude? It seems multifaceted.
It really is. It's the core tragedy. Ultimately, it stems from this profound inability to truly connect, to truly love or share vulnerability. They're all trapped, looking inward, obsessed with their own pride, like Amaranta, their own wars, like the Colonel, their own knowledge, like Jose Arcadio Biendia or Aureliano Babilonia.
And they're trapped in cyclical time.
Yes. That repetition of names, the Aureliano's always solitary and introspective, the Jose Arcadio's impulsive and physical, it's Gabo's way of showing they're condemned to repeat their history. They don't learn, they don't break the pattern.
Which links directly to that theme of memory and truth. The novel seems deeply skeptical of official history.
Deeply. The massacre is the prime example. Power tries to erase truth to make it fiction. So personal memory, like the kind Jose Arcadio Segundo guards so fiercely in his isolation, becomes this crucial act of resistance. It might be the only honest record left.
And the style itself reinforces this, the language.
Definitely. That dense, lush, hypnotic prose, those long, winding sentences that feel like they could go on forever, they mirror the sprawling, tangled nature of the family's history. It creates this dreamlike, immersive atmosphere where, yeah, the impossible feels utterly real.
We should also mention those powerful symbols that linger long after you finish reading, the yellow butterflies.
Ah, yes. Always surrounding Mauricio Babilonia whenever he's near me. Such a beautiful yet tragic symbol of their forbidden love, their doomed destiny.
And the Colonel's golden fishes.
The perfect symbol of his life's work in a way. Meticulously crafted, beautiful, but ultimately pointless labor. Made, melted down, remade. A cycle of intricate futility mirroring his own emotional solitude.
So the lasting impression, it's a mix, isn't it? Melancholy, certainly, but also a kind of exhilaration from the sheer scope and imagination. It leaves you with this profound sense of history's weight, but also how fluid reality can be.
It really does. It's an astonishing book that forces you, the reader, to consider that maybe the most powerful forces shaping us, love, memory, obsession, fate, are just as tangible, just as inescapable as the ground we walk on.
Perhaps the novel's ultimate tragic insight is that fate isn't some external force decreeing things. It's the cumulative result of 100 years of shared, desperate loneliness that the Buendia simply couldn't break free from.
A powerful thought. They were condemned by their inability to truly see each other.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekater Foundation.